I'll be fine. I mean, don't worry.
Do they do this often?
Yeah, well, we have to get, record just silence in the room, which helps the producer fade in and fade out and make it sound more natural. Generally they have. Is that what you meant, or is that?
No, I mean, I've never done an interview like this before, where they have someone taping one side as opposed to just having a questioner.
Yeah, I think with telephone interviews on certain radio situations where you're like not in the same studio, that's one way I've known of doing it.
Do you need to use restroom or anything?
No, I won't. They're supposed to call it 2, right? Hello? Can you hear it through the speaker?
All right, testing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Can you hear me now okay? All right.
Fine. Can you just say your name and where we are?
Yeah, we're in Washington, D.C., capital of the greatest empire since the earth trembled before the legions of Rome, followed by the British Empire. Subject of today's documentary. So that works okay?
Yeah, it seems to be fine.
Well, let's hope this number works. What if you put your arm, your elbow there? And that way you'll rest it. How about that? That's better, isn't it? Okay. Because I don't think you can keep your arm raised, even for 30 minutes.
Testing, 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 testing. Testing.
So you're here in Washington?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm actually a grad student.
Is that
a day job, yeah.
How did you get involved in this?
I study linguistics, so mm-hmm. I have a recorder and all this stuff, and my partner also moonlights as a producer,
mm-hmm.
so he's so we've both been doing this off and on.
So what do you do with linguistics and recorders? Dialects or?
Yeah, you can
English or other languages?
English and other languages, mm-hmm. yeah. I study language in use in society,
mm-hmm.
so dialects. And
in the U.S.?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I can lapse back into my regional Texan dialect.
Is that so?
Yeah, this is the standard NBC dialect.
Yeah, yeah. Good. Where are you from originally?
From Austin, Texas.
Austin. Oh, my friend from school is doing a presentation in Austin right now,
mm-hmm.
at a linguistics conference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I know all these accents.
That's good.
There's the New York. Boston.
Boston.
Right.
Yeah. We got more of them out east, but...
Yeah, that's curious, isn't it?
Yeah.
No, my native accent is the Highland Southern. It's like this, very harsh Irish, Scots-Irish. Then there's actually two southern accents, you know. Then there's the coastal.
Okay, right.
And the difference is here, there, and everywhere. They're here, there, and everywhere.
Okay, so yeah, it's pronounced
your R's. One is English and one is Scots-Irish.
Interesting.
The more genteel one is the English one.
Yeah. Of course, that doesn't include any, like, of the sort of deep Appalachian or any of the...
Well, Appalachian is Scots-Irish, so very into that.
Quite like that, yeah. Have you ever heard any of the... I mean, there's the coastal south, but then there's, like, the sea islands off the Carolinas and
like
things.
Like Gullah and all that.
Yeah, Gullah, and there's some other communities out there that have crazy-sounding accents.
South Carolina has a strange accent, too. I think it's the old South Carolina-Virginia accent.
Mm.
Like Fritz Hollings, Senator Fritz Hollings, he has that. They say hoose instead of house.
Huh.
Like, why don't y'all come on up to the hoose after a while and we'll have ourselves some mint juleps. That's the old George Washington accent.
I wonder where that comes from. That must just be like an old variant.
Yeah. Hoose and a boot.
Yeah. That's basically, yeah. Kind of the genre stuff I'm interested in.
Do you know David Hackett Fisher? He's a historian. He's traced these dialects back to counties and regions in Britain.
In Britain? Mm-hmm.
In the 16th, 17th, 18th century. Michael Lind. Oh, hi. Okay, now, just one warning. As I told your producer, I know a great deal about the American reception of Churchill. I'm not a Churchill biographer. So don't ask me what he was doing on April 22nd, 1899. I won't be able to tell you. Well, good. Then you can tell me. Well, what was he doing on April 22nd, 1899? Yeah, I want to know. That's what I was thinking. Somewhere in Africa, wasn't he? I know that much. Right. Whatever. Yes, the crew singular, very, very talented fellow who's holding a microphone to my mouth even as we speak. And we're in the more or less soundproof studio, except that it has an air conditioning unit in the background. But that's air conditioning. I hope it doesn't show up too much. Well, if you can't hear it, then it's not a problem, maybe. Okay, sure. Sure. Thanks.
He said he can't hear me.
Okay. Yeah.
My grandfather was a sound engineer in the 1920s. He used to set up movie theaters.
Oh, those, yeah.
So he said what you want is coffered walls and coffered ceilings.
Like, kind of scooped out,
yeah.
Or?
and that then breaks up the sound waves. Whenever you have flat surfaces,
this reflects, really.
Reflects the sound.
Yeah, sound
so
engineers.
Why would you have a studio with flat walls and lots of glass? I don't understand. Because the architects thought it looked cool, I guess.
Huh. They don't really. Probably weren't sound engineers, were they?
It's interesting because it's just purely physical design. I mean, it's not the materials so much as the shape.
Yeah. I mean, there's crazy things you read about, like in old amphitheaters, to get more projection, they'd have like these urns set into the wall that would kind of vibrate harmonically with the speaker's voice, and that would transmit the noise a little further. It's like this old Greek thing, and then finally brought it back with the Sydney Opera House.
Cool, I never heard about that.
Yeah, it's really fascinating stuff.
Well, it's not too late to get some basses or something.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think we're good on levels. Not enough noise. So he's going to call back?
Yeah,
okay.
He's setting up on that end.
Okay.
Is it WNET?
I'm just a hired gun. I really don't know anything about the whole operation.
It could all be a fraud for all we know.
Yeah, I'm actually not working for them. But I got the impression they were in New York, or?
Yeah, I think he's in New York.
Okay.
This fellow, David Darcy.
Michael Lind. Hi. Yes, I can hear you fine. How about you? Can you hear me? I lived in New York for 4 years, and whenever people would call me from around the country, they would say, "Don't you need to evacuate your building?" And I said, "That's just ambient noise in New York. It's really, you know, relax." Right. Well, I'm glad you have the sound effects for the documentary. I'm now, my present title is Policy Director of, I don't know, I'm still Whitehead Senior Fellow. For purposes of this, why don't we say Whitehead Senior Fellow of the New America Foundation in Washington, D.C. No, you can't. So just forget I even mentioned policy director. You can say I'm a fellow at the New America Foundation. That'll work. Well, because I had written... Well, can we start over again? Is this... Yeah, I'm right. Well, by the beginning of the 21st century, there was a big partisan divide in the United States over the reputation of Churchill on the right, particularly among neoconservatives. He was a hero, arguably the central figure of the 20th century, even for American neoconservatives. On the left, Franklin Roosevelt had always overshadowed Churchill. So I was interested in the reasons why American conservatives in particular had made such an iconic figure out of a foreign statesman. Well, there were several factors. The American right during the Cold War was defined by opposition to communism, which it viewed as a threat equally as grave as National Socialism in World War II. And Churchill, because of his Iron Curtain speech, because of his career-long anti-communism, which dated back to the 1920s, notwithstanding his cooperation with Stalin during World War II, was the hero of anti-communists on both sides of the Atlantic. In addition, conservatives were fond during the Cold War of accusing American liberals of being appeasers, and the imagery of Neville Chamberlain and the appeasement of Hitler during the 1930s was used again and again by American conservatives in polemics against liberals who were accused of appeasing the Soviet Union. Then after 1989, with the collapse of communism and the end of the Cold War, this same rhetorical trope of the liberals being the appeasers and the Neville Chamberlains and the conservatives being the anti-totalitarian Winston Churchills was recycled, this time for jihadism. I don't remember, you know, exactly. Next question. Oh, definitely. Because by the 1990s, the neoconservatives who had originally been Wilsonian, Rooseveltian liberals, they were Cold War liberals who had broken with the Democrats as the Democrats became more dovish and less militant in the 1970s following the Vietnam War. By the 1990s, the neoconservatives had made their peace with the Republican tradition, which had always denounced Franklin Roosevelt, primarily because of his domestic New Deal policies. But there was a strain in Republican Party thought that said Roosevelt had been duped by Stalin during World War II, that from the very beginning, he had not seen the true nature of communism, which Winston Churchill had understood. So whereas Ronald Reagan could tell Dan Rather during a televised interview during the Reagan years that his favorite president, Reagan's favorite president, was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, by the 1990s, Roosevelt was such a hate figure by the right, neoconservatives as well as conservatives, that the true hero of World War II, and hence the true foreign policy model, was Winston Churchill. That's exactly my argument. I think they look at the Churchill of 1939 through 1941, when the U.S. was still outside of World War II, and Britain was embattled and besieged by Nazi Germany. And they also look at the Churchill of the early Cold War period, and they take these two moments to create this myth, which has its basis, in fact, of the brave spokesman for liberal and democratic values standing up to totalitarianism. If you look at Churchill at other times in his career, he's the spokesman of imperial values against national self-determination. For example, his views of the Arab desire for national self-determination in the Middle East, of Gandhi, whom he dismissed as a fakir. So different Churchills from different periods serve different polemical purposes in American and, I think, contemporary British political argument. That's okay. Oh, yes, I think there, well, let me start over again. I think the difference between the heroic image of Churchill in the United States and the more skeptical view of Churchill in the United Kingdom has to do with different conservative traditions. There's a strain on the British right, on the British Tory right, which thinks Churchill was too close to the United States and was too willing to accede to Franklin Roosevelt's pressure for dismantling the Soviet, there's a strain on the British Tory right that thinks Churchill acceded too easily to pressure from the Americans to dismantle the British Empire and to dismantle imperial preference, to reduce Britain to a secondary power dependent on the United States, and to create the United Nations system along essentially American Wilsonian lines after World War II. And so this strain of British conservatives argues that if Churchill had kept more of a distance from the United States during World War II, then Britain might have emerged from the war as more of a great power, and the British Empire, to some degree, might have survived, or at least mutated into a kind of British Commonwealth would have more substance than it does today. So there's it's somewhat eccentric, but there's a strain on the British right that views Churchill as the person who sold the U.S. out, So there is this strain on the British right that views Churchill as someone who sold the British Empire out to the anti-imperial Americans. Well, it's important to remember that despite the lionization of Winston Churchill by most of the American community after World War II, in the early years of the war and during the war, there was a substantial body of liberal and leftist opinion in the United States that saw the war not as a battle of democracy versus totalitarianism, but as a clash between various aggressive empires, not only the German and the Japanese, but also the British and the French. So in the minds of American critics of Churchill during World War II, Churchill was the emblem of the British Empire rather than the symbol of democracy. I think if they looked at all of the aspects of Churchill's personality and career, they would find many things that are incompatible with their particular values. But that problem doesn't arise because they essentially excerpt a couple of shining heroic moments from Churchill's career, essentially in World War II and the early Cold War, and pretty much ignore the rest. There is one exception to that. In the late 1990s, in the early 2000s, the neoconservative writer Max Boot and others got very interested in counterinsurgency. There was this idea that we would be fighting wars against insurgents, not only in Iraq, but elsewhere in the world. And there was Robert Kaplan, as well as Max Boot, wrote something about the young Churchill as the young officer of the British Empire engaged in battles in Africa. That really didn't go anywhere, and as the American public turned against the cost of the war in Iraq, very little has been heard of this sort of Kipling-esque, you know, late 19th century romanticism about the British Empire. Oh, I think that's right. And as I've argued, George W. Bush, like Margaret Thatcher, and arguably Churchill himself, was a conviction politician, someone who made his decision and stuck with it and was convinced that reconsideration was a sign of weakness. And you see that in Churchill himself. He had brilliant ideas, and then he had terrible ideas, which he persisted in long after everyone else had concluded they were terrible. For example, his idea that the way to cripple the Nazis during World War II was to strike through the Balkans, which he described as the soft underbelly of Europe. Well, it's anything but soft, even if it is an underbelly. So there was this mixture of genius and folly in Churchill, as in other conviction politicians. But you can understand why, to a wartime president, that sort of example of bold, decisive leadership and persistence in maturing plans would have a lot of appeal. Well, I think there is a parallel, and it was made at the time in 1992 that you had this popular wartime leader then rejected by the American electorate in the same way the British electorate had rejected Churchill after World War II. I think in both cases the economy was the chief consideration. In the United States, Bill Clinton's mantra was, "It's the economy, stupid." The relatively costless victory in Iraq mattered less to voters than the recession that the U.S. was then undergoing. In the case of Britain, Churchill had managed to unite the British people behind him by means of a coalition with the Labour Party and by promising very grandiose visions of the welfare state and of new wage structures and of rebuilding after the war. And when it came to rebuilding Britain after the war, the British people preferred the Labour Party to the Conservatives, who had been very reluctant in making these promises during the war itself. Well, I think in the case of Margaret Thatcher's electoral victories, you have to remember that she never got more than slightly of more than 40% of the popular vote. It was because the left was divided during the 1980s between the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats that the Conservatives prevailed. So had the two left-wing parties in Britain coalesced into a single alternative, then Margaret Thatcher, after the Falklands War, might very well have reenacted Churchill's electoral fate after World War II. That's right. But then if you look at 2006, his party loses Congress, largely over the backlash to the mounting costs of the war in Iraq. And then more as a result of the crash of the economy, I think, than of the war, his party loses the presidency. So I think that had the election been held slightly later, in early 2005, say, at the time when American public was shifting decisively against the Iraq war, the outcome would have been different. Oh, yes, I would. And I think if you asked most presidential speechwriters if they had a fantasy candidate they could write speeches for, it would be Winston Churchill. It would not be any American Democrats or Republicans. There's a difference between American political culture and British political culture in that respect, which I think prevails even to this day. British prime ministers have to be very articulate and very eloquent. They have to be able to speak extemporaneously on their feet because that's the basis to their success, rising within their parties, but also rising within Parliament. The American system is much more fragmented. It relies much less on speech making and more on office meetings and memos and personal conversations. And it is possible for relatively inarticulate figures like George W. Bush to rise to the top in the American political system. I don't think that's possible in a parliamentary system like Britain's. Well, I think devolution is not a bad word for it. If you compare the Lincoln-Douglas debates to Franklin Roosevelt's fireside chats to modern televised presidential State of the Union addresses, you find that the sentences are becoming simpler and simpler, that complex arguments are not being made. You tend to have strings of very simple talking points. And I think part of this is the shift from an oratorical culture to a visual culture where people have much shorter attention spans and are unwilling to listen to a prolonged argument. In addition, there's the post-60s rebellion in favor of authenticity, which in oratory, as in other arts, favors the plain over the fancy. So I think that if a politician, even in Britain, used the kind of grandiose rhetoric that Churchill used at his climaxes of his oratory, this would be snickered at today. People would find it ridiculous or pompous rather than moving. Well, I think in the circumstances, the alternative to sacrifice was Nazi conquest. So I think in less grievous circumstances, it's not surprising that calls for sacrifice would fall on deaf ears. Well, the British historian Corelli Barnett made the interesting point in one of his studies of World War II that at the time of World War I and World War II, the average Briton was working class or rural, lived in what would be considered third world conditions today, was used to truly grueling labor that would just be unimaginably backbreaking for modern inhabitants of Britain or the United States. And so when they went off to war, it was not that much of a difference from their daily existence, apart from, you know, the imminent physical danger. But the actual material luxuries that they were giving up were not particularly luxurious. So he made the point that all of the Western societies, and the United States probably like that too, in World War I and World War II, the vast majority of the people in the armies, but also on the home front, lived much more modestly and were accustomed to far more material sacrifice than their grandchildren and great-grandchildren are today. That may have been a factor. C- Barnett makes the point that certainly the medical care was better than anything people were getting back at home. And that's one of the reasons why the British medical service, socialized medicine in Britain, was adopted with so little controversy following World War II. It had been a wartime measure, and it worked very impressively. I don't remember. I think they asked me to write it, but I'm not. Yeah. I don't recall that I did. I think they originally, just off the record, they asked me to write about, you know, the Churchill cult among neoconservatives, which to them is British. They're more or less moderate British conservatives. They just thought it was kind of peculiar. And well, whether Churchill is of use to Republicans, there's one British Prime Minister who will always be of use to the more hawkish conservatives, and that is Neville Chamberlain. Now, for more than half a century, the right has accused Democrats of being Chamberlain-type appeasers, no matter who the enemy of the day is. And since this is one of the great themes of political commentary, whenever an American president, even a Republican president, does something that conservative hawks thinks concedes too much to the other side, be it the Soviets or the Iranians, they respond with these claims of Neville Chamberlain and the appeasement of Hitler and over Czechoslovakia and so on. So I think you have to remember that in American mythology, Churchill is always partnered with Chamberlain. They work together as a team. One is the good guy, one is the bad guy. One is the great statesman, one is the failure. And it's that dynamic that informs the use of Churchill, along with his partner, Chamberlain, as it were, in American polemics. Oh, of course, if you look at another hero of Americans across the political spectrum, Abraham Lincoln, he's remembered selectively for different things by different political parties. For the neoconservative right, it's for standing up for the principle of inalienable rights against what they consider to be relativism and what they accuse liberals of promoting, a kind of historical relativism. So they idealized Lincoln for defending timeless perennial truths about human nature. For the left, Lincoln is a hero of civil rights, a precursor of Martin Luther King Jr. Now, the facts are somewhat embarrassing to both sides. Lincoln offered many compromises to the South, which would have brought about reunion with slavery intact, guaranteed to survive for several generations at least. So that tends to embarrass the right, which sees this uncompromising Lincoln. And the left, of course, doesn't know what to do with the fact that Lincoln, for much of his career, well into the Civil War, supported the colonization of freed slaves outside of the borders of the United States, which indicates that he didn't believe in the possibility of a integrated multiracial society. Now, that may have changed during the course of the war, but that's disputed. So I think all historical figures, there are aspects of their careers that are taken out of context and idealized, and then they become these larger-than-life icons standing for certain eternal values. Well, I think it means being courageous as a political leader when your policies and your views might be unpopular, although in the long run they would be vindicated. Certainly the people who would like to think of themselves as Churchillian, as I gather George W. Bush did, would like to believe that that in the long run history will prove that they were right. And you know, sometimes there's a quote from Churchill that's invoked in this connection. Churchill said, "History will prove me right. I know because I will write the history," since he was a great historian and a novelist as well as a great politician. Most statesmen, however, are unable to write the history of their own administrations, so they have to hope that they will be considered Churchillian in retrospect because their currently unpopular policies are vindicated. Well, thank you. I'm glad to be of help. Yes, it's a nonpartisan public policy research center in Washington, D.C. Do you need more than that? Yeah, we study both foreign and domestic policy, as well as issues of economic growth in the next social contract. Sure. Well, I think for some neoconservatives, Churchill's support for Zionism in the early 20th century certainly added to his appeal, although I think the basis of the appeal for the neoconservatives as for other Americans was his standing up to Hitler and then warning about Stalin. I think that was the main aspect of it. But one area about which very few Americans know, Israelis know more about this, was Churchill's role as a colonial secretary in the 1920s, where he helped draw the lines for what later became Jordan and Palestine or Israel. And he also played a role in actually inventing the kingdom originally of Iraq by consolidating the Ottoman provinces of Baghdad, Basra, and Mosul. In cobbling together something which almost immediately began to fall apart, and it was held together by British invasion and British-backed proxy rulers who were eventually overthrown in the 1960s. And then it has tended to fall apart repeatedly throughout its history. But again, this is an aspect of Churchill's career about which almost nobody in the United States knows. There's been some interest in it in Britain. Particularly as the British, like the Americans, got involved in Iraq as well. And there was some interest in Churchill's role in the British colonial policy that created both Iraq and what became the modern state of Israel. Thank you. Okay, do you need to speak to your sound technician, or is everything on board? Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Oh, no, not at all. Patrick. Right. Correct, yeah, I got all the FTP information and all that good stuff. So. All right, thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you, Sam. Yeah. All right.
So your elbow is okay.
Oh, it's just fine. Thank you.